Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Bijou Banter. In the KUY studio, we got Daniel Merger-Gahoyer.
Hello, how's it going, guys?
And myself, Matthew Hutt. And today, it is Friday, December 9th of 2022. This is our last episode of Bijou Banter for the 2022 fall semester. We'll be back in January talking about more films. But today, on December 9th, we're talking about The Fabelmans, which is the latest film from the acclaimed director known as Steven Spielberg, as well as a holiday special on Disney Plus called The Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special. And we're going to begin this episode with talking about The Fabelmans, as stated, latest film from Steven Spielberg. Everybody knows who Spielberg is. He's done Jaws, Indiana Jones, E.T., Jurassic Park, Schindler's List, Saving Pirate Ryan. List goes on. He's one of the greatest directors of all time. And it stars Michelle Williams, Paul Dano, Seth Rogen, Gabriel LaBelle, and Judd Hirsch, among others. And this is a semi-autobiographical story which is about a teenager named Sammy Fabelman who aspires to become a filmmaker and realizes that he discovers this shattering family secret and explores how the power of films can help see the truth. That's from IMDb. And what do we think about this movie?
I'm guessing before we start, thoughts on Spielberg. I think Spielberg, I mean, for me as a filmmaker, has always been an influence of mine. I feel like, although, like, yeah, there are some aspects of Steven Spielberg that, you know, definitely a repetitive, like, sentimentalism that he always puts in his films, or the sentimentality that he puts in his film, for a better phrase. He definitely is a director you can't ignore. I mean, there's a lot of, Spielberg has done so much over the years. I mean, he's been directing for, like, 50 years now. Mm-hmm. He's been going at it ever since the 70s. He's been amazing. And obviously, I think, like, in the latter half of the 2000s, early 2010s, it kind of feels like Spielberg has been coasting a little bit. I think his last great film has been Lincoln. And although I do like some of his recent ones, like Bridge of Spies and West Side Story, I do kind of feel like those are types of films that still have their fair share of issues. But with this one, it's like, I think there's like something about it that honestly hit me hard after I left the theater. I drove all the way to Davenport like late Monday night after like a long day of editing another video, and it was like such a long ride, and it's like, am I making the right choice, like going all the way to see a movie in Davenport at 10 o'clock at night? And to be honest, like, it kind of hit me hard because it kind of shows, like, you know, where inspiration comes from. And Spielberg, like, although a lot of his stories definitely had that semi-autobiographical take on it, this is obviously about his parents, which, you know, it's not the first time there's been a movie about a divorce. Like, you still get it from E.T., you still get it from Close Encounters. It's a common element in his films. But I feel like this one, it felt so grounded and a little bit different from those. And it definitely shows, like, you know, how hard it was for him growing up, not just as a kid who is Jewish, but also, like, you know, just with a family that's kind of being torn apart in the process. And it is, like, one of those films, like, you know, you gotta kind of, like, look back at yourself and realize, like, what has inspired me and how was I able to keep myself going through those inspirations despite the fact that I've been, like, despite all, like, this, all these external factors kind of coming at me. And I think that's what makes The Fabelmans so great to me.
Yeah, before I get into my thoughts, I forgot to mention, too, The Fabelmans is opening up this weekend at Film Scene at the Chauncey in downtown Iowa City. It opens up today, so yeah, check it out if you would like to. But anyway, my history with Spielberg at one point was my all-time favorite director. He no longer holds that title, but he's still in my top five. And he's definitely one of my biggest inspirations, as well as one of the sparks that got me interested in films for many, many years. E.T. was my favorite movie. And even though he didn't direct Back to the Future, he produced it. That's still in my top three favorite movies of all time. So Spielberg, every time he makes a new film, I get excited just because I know automatically it's like, okay, I know what I'm getting into. And especially recently, Spielberg has kind of gone away from doing escapist entertainment and instead doing more serious period pieces. And some of them have been hit or miss, especially in the 2010s. There, he had some duds, but recently he's been coming back. We briefly talked about West Side Story in a previous banter episode. I believe it was our top 10, which I loved. I thought it was his best movie in such a long time. And The Fabelmans seemed like, this is not his last film. I just want to preface that. He actually is planning to make a remake of Bullet. But if this were to be his final film, let's say he retired after this, this would be the perfect send-off because it is such a beautiful and profound love letter to not only filmmaking, but also dreamers. And it's refreshing to know that even someone as inspirational and influential as Spielberg, he started off like one of us. He was also a dreamer, that one kid who wanted to make movies and wanted to devote his entire life to doing so. And even if you don't have a filmmaking background, even if you're not interested in films at all, you can relate to this story in some way, especially if you have a similar passion. And I think this movie really captures that well, as along with like nostalgia and coming of age. And miraculously, it doesn't feel like Spielberg is ever tooting his own horn. It never goes down the route where it's like egocentric. Detractors could probably label this as sentimental and also cheesy, and this is definitely going to be a front runner for Oscars this coming award season, but it's still a very well told personal story which focuses on its characters and also its dynamics. And there was a really great documentary about Steven Spielberg on HBO. I think it's called Spielberg. Came out a few years ago, and it really explored his personal life as well as growing up with his parents. His parents got divorced in real life, and how that had an effect on him, but also was sort of like pushing him to move forward with his directing career. That is captured very well, even though this is not about him. It is about himself kind of metaphorically, but it's a fictional story. And it balances the tone between like real life and fiction in a way that only Spielberg can do. So I really, really liked The Fabelmans, and I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, it definitely, like, has, like, a different type of feel compared to his other films. For starters, like, the score is very minimalistic. This is with his common collaborator, John Williams, who is actually set to retire after Indiana Jones 5. The guy is hitting...
He's, like, 92.
Yeah, he's, like, 92. The man's been going at it for years. And to be honest, this is kind of where I predicted John Williams would kind of end with Spielberg, because the thing about Williams was a concert jazz pianist. Like, he wasn't, because although, like, his scores really contain a lot of strings, he was a piano player. Mm-hmm. And so, honestly, I kind of felt like the score was, like, very fitting, because Williams, like, always knows how to use the piano effectively. And this here, like, works pretty well, especially if, like, Michelle Williams playing the mother, you know, playing the piano. And although they did bring in another, a professional piano player, I think like from the LA Philharmonic, to actually do all the piano solos, you can still kind of say it has that Williams touch to it, where it's like Williams can kind of like convert a song from Bach and make it sound like John Williams. And I think like, that worked effectively. The cinematography, I think, worked pretty well, too. Mm-hmm. I think it's had, like, that very, like, same minimalistic feel, but you do kind of see, like, Spielberg running around the, like, not Spielberg, well, it technically is Spielberg, but you do see Sammy, like, kind of running around with the Bolex and just, you know, taking shots of, like, his family, and kind of, like, has that nice home video type feel. But there's always like this one thing I do like about Spielberg, it's like when he has like those one takes where the camera is still, but you can still kind of see like the actors move in the background, and sometimes you focus on that. Like, there's this scene in the beginning of the movie where like Sammy's going to bed, and you see Paul Dano just kind of walking out of the room and like grab something. So I feel like there's always like something that Spielberg's able to like muster up pretty nicely with like his one take shots and just make it seem very like very nice, but also like make you think about the characters a lot. I think he does that a lot too.
It's interesting talking about cinematography, especially after West Side Story, because West Side Story was such a large, expansive looking movie. And The Fablemans is way more intimately shot, which is obviously intentional just because this is a smaller scale story, but it captures the time period and also the limited nature of cinematography at the time. Obviously, the story takes place, I'm guessing, around like the 50s to 60s.
1940s to 60s, I would say.
I guess it would be more of the 50s, because if we're basing this off of Spielberg's mm-hmm. life, Spielberg was born in the mid-40s, and if he's a teenager, let's just say late 50s to early 60s. It'll be around there.
Yeah, because Greatest Show on Earth came out like...
Greatest Show on Earth was 52. Yeah, so, 52. And that's the opening scene of this movie, and for those of you that know Spielberg's history, that was the movie that made him that discovered his love of movies, was seeing Cecil B. DeMille's Greatest Show on Earth, which I've never seen before, but now I really want to after seeing this movie. But he really captures the time period extremely well. And that's something I've noticed about Spielberg's recent films, especially ones that take place in the 50s era, which West Side Story was around the same time too, Bridge of Spies as well. He really knows how to make the time period feel alive. And with The Fablemans, it's no exception, because the production design, flawless. Costume design, flawless. Mm-hmm. And the way he shoots it, or I guess specifically Janusz Kaminski, who also is a frequent collaborator of Spielberg, is a cinematographer. He shoots these scenes with a lot of emphasis on the lighting and a lot of emphasis on making these images, this film footage look like photographs too. Even sometimes he transitions to film footage that was probably shot with a Bolex or something similar.
Yeah, like 16 millimeter. Yeah.
16 millimeter. There's probably my favorite scene in the movie, which is hard for me to discuss in depth because it's sort of one of the big reveals. It's when Sammy is working at an editing table and there's no dialogue. It's just the music and also how the cuts of him going back to the footage are edited so methodically. That's a standout sequence and shows how the technical elements also go into the emotional storytelling of these characters. Because it is, as much as this is a dialogue-heavy film, it's also focuses on the images, because that's what's so profound and what sticks out in our memories, especially with movie-going memories, is the images. We think of seeing, like, let's just say theoretically, like if we were to watch Star Wars, we remember the image of Luke staring off into the sunset. Or we remember the boulder chasing Indiana Jones. It's like those are the things that really stick out. In this case, for Sammy, it's the train crash from Greatest Show on Earth.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it just kind of shows, like, you know, how a lot of images, like, no matter how hard to look at, really do leave significant impacts. It's just because, you know, I work with a documentary photographer over at the DI, and he, like, the day we I went here on campus, and the thing that he always, like, kind of shows is, like, how a lot of his protégés or students kind of take these photos, and a lot of these photos leave, like, significant impacts on these people's lives. And it is true. Like, it's not just, like, film, but a lot of, like, images, like, sometimes they're so striking to us that sometimes we can't think about any of them, like, anything but that, because it's all ingrained in our minds. And that's kind of like the whole beauty of like filmmaking. It's that filmmaking, a lot of those images can really stick inside of your head long after you leave the theater. And I think that's what Spielberg really gets down beautifully in that sequence.
We're going to transition into a quick PSA and we'll be right back with more Bijou Banter. Welcome back to Bijou Banter. We are continuing our conversation on The Fablemans. And as much as this is a story about the character Sammy, it equally focuses on his home life with his parents, specifically played by Michelle Williams and Paul Dano, both of which do fantastic performances as normal. They're wonderful actors, and Williams especially really, really impressed me in this role. And I've always liked Michelle Williams as an actress, but seeing how much of the story is focused on her relationship with her son, as well as just sort of the overall family dynamics and how that leads into Sammy discovering this truth about her, is heartbreaking to see. And also because this character is very flawed, but also is so supportive of what her son wants to do. And not to say that Paul Dano's character isn't supportive, but he's more of the, he supports his family because he's a computer programmer, like an early computer programmer,
yeah, like,
or engineer, I guess.
Yeah, Spielberg's dad, like, apparently was a pretty big, like,
yeah,
like, computer guy, like, because he was part of the reason, like, why RCA was such a big thing.
I think IBM as well, too.
Yeah, like, he did a lot of things.
Yeah, and that dynamic really works because these characters feel so realistic, and the dialogue that they have and the interactions, too. Even if it shows their relationships not really getting along, they still feel like a very believable family. And admittedly, Sammy does have siblings too. I think like three other sisters, and they're not really as developed. So
I mean, I would say the one that really is the one in the glasses, which I think is based off of his sister Ann Spielberg,
probably,
who was also a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I mean, I think Spielberg, like, you know, I think he encapsulates the family dynamic so well. And I think part of the reason is that the thing that, like, people really, that's really underrated about Spielberg is his way to work with child actors.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like there's something, because I think there's, like, whole reasons why, like, Henry Thomas is so good in E.T. and, like, how Drew Barrymore was so good in E.T. because they encapsulate kids. He encapsulates kids so well. Because he kind of shows, like, you know, that they're very childlike in some areas, but sometimes they just have moments of, like, pure awe or inspiration or, you know, pure emotion. And sometimes stuff that, you know, really a lot of kids go through. And the thing, like, that was always, like, so impactful about, like, E.T. to me is, like, when you kind of see the main character going through these emotions, as E.T.'s kind of going through these emotions. And, you know, it really encapsulates that, like, childlike mannerisms and, you know, emotion. And Spielberg always does that incredibly well. I mean, I think Gabriel Rabel does a great job of, like, you know, really growing through the role. And really feels like a young Spielberg when you're, like, watching him. Because he just has that passion, but also that emotion that Spielberg was feeling at that time.
Yeah. I will say probably my biggest issue with The Fablemans is honestly the length. I think the movie is really a little too long. And it's interesting because I commented upon the editing in this movie. For most part, especially in the first half, the editing is really, really good, especially when emphasizing the visual language. In the second half, it's almost like it was edited by another person because the pacing really drags to a halt. And because it does follow Spielberg's childhood in terms of like him moving out, he moved all over the place. So this movie takes place in like New Jersey and then Arizona and then ends with him in California where he spent his high school time. And by the time we get to California, it almost seems like the movie's about to wrap up, but there's almost like another hour left of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, that's where it kind of started to lose me because then the conflict gets addressed, but then there's all this other stuff too because when he's in high school, he's basically, he's bullied and has anti-Semitic abuse pretty much for being Jewish.
Yeah.
And that's the part where like those interactions don't feel nearly as genuine as the interactions with his family. Cause that's when, in my opinion, it doesn't really become overly over dramatic, but in the high school scenes, that's where it does. Cause honestly, some of his supporting cast members as high school students aren't that great.
I mean, I don't know. I think they still, I think some of them really pulled it off pretty well. I think, but I do kind of see that as a flaw because I feel like the film does try to, like, I think they do want to emphasize a lot of his growth, which, you know, I think it's still done incredibly well. I think they really established, like, the character kind of growing through this prejudice within this high school of his, like, senior year. You know, having a relationship with somebody that does not have the same beliefs as him. Like, he practically falls in love with her, but she's not him. Like, she doesn't have, like, she's Christian, he's Jewish, and they both, and not to say, like, that's, like, the main reason why things don't go the way they did, but it does kind of, like, meander a little bit in those areas. But I don't know, I think they still pulled it off pretty well. I think that one scene, like, after the whole prom video, like, I really do like the acting from the guy who was the so-called jerk in this film.
Which one? There were two of them.
Like, it was the one that was kind of like a frat boy.
Like, was he like the super athletic one?
Yeah, super athletic one.
Like, yeah, his performance was definitely better than the other bully.
Yeah, yeah.
That's for sure. I don't, who's the actor? Or I don't even know. I don't remember what his character's name was. But he, sort of the skinnier one.
Yeah,
one
the that was more, a little more one, lanky. Yeah, and it's like, I mean, not really, I think like the acting, like still, I don't know, I think the acting was still solid.
It's not that it's like bad acting, but there are some performances in here that are so good and it's hard to compete. And going back to what you said about Spielberg and directing either child or adolescent actors, I think he's just done better directing though, like directing these child actors.
Oh, yeah.
More so, I've noticed if they're under 10, he really knows how to direct them. Kind of like what you said with E.T. or even, I've never seen AI, but lot of people mentioned Haley Joel Osment great in AI.
Yeah, he did good in that. The thing that I was surprised about, though, acting-wise, I think Zeph Rogen gives a solid performance.
He's good.
Yeah, he didn't annoy me. I mean, no, he still has, like, the dumb stoner laugh, but he doesn't, like, I feel like he still gives, like, a really good performance.
It's a more nuanced role, and I hope Seth Rogen does more stuff like this, just because I think he is a good actor when given the right role. Like, he was really good in the Steve Jobs movie. I think he played Steve Wozniak.
Yeah,
he was good in that. And I thought he was going to do more dramatic stuff, but he hasn't done that in a while, and it's nice to see him in this. And speaking of recognition, The Fabelmans is considered a front runner for Best Picture. Do you think this is going to win Best Picture?
Ooh, that's going to be tough. I mean, this has already been a good year in film with Everything Everywhere All at Once, Banshees of Inisherin. I mean, there's a lot of like good films that have come out this year. We'll probably see. I mean, I think in terms of nominations, I could see picture and director. I could definitely see Best Supporting Actress and Actor for Paul Dano and Michelle Williams. Maybe it could get Best Screenplay, and I think they're going to nominate Williams anyway. Mm-hmm. They're probably just going to nominate him just for the sake of it, because it is like his last like collaboration with Spielberg. And definitely production design, costume, even editing. I think he'll still get like some nominations.
Yeah, I do think this has a very good chance at winning Best Picture. Personally, it's not my choice for Best Picture. I would give that to Everything Everywhere All at Once, but I know that probably won't win either. So if this does win, I will not be disappointed at all. If anything, I'll be happy, because it is definitely sentimental Oscar bait, which I think maybe that's what most people love this movie, but there are some people that argue it's like, oh, it's just Spielberg doing the same sentimental, you know, crud all over again. And which I guess is fair to a point, but also because it's such a personal story, I think that elevates it to be more than just art, like sentimental art, pretty much.
Yeah.
And there is more.
It does feel more grounded.
It does feel more grounded. I don't think his goal with this movie was to win awards. Mm-hmm. He knew that he was going to get award nomination, that's for sure. But it's such a personal story. You could tell he wanted to tell it. And also, this is one of the few films, at least recently, that Spielberg has directed that he's also written too. That's something a lot of people don't know, is that Spielberg, he obviously is a director, but he doesn't write nearly as much as he used to. He wrote Close Encounters. I think he wrote AI. I think that's the last movie he wrote. I don't think he's written anything since.
I mean, I feel like, you know, stories that, you know, Spielberg, because he's not like a super good writer. I mean, there's a reason why he brings in Tony Kushner, because Kushner is a pretty solid writer regardless. Yeah. I mean, if you watch Lincoln, like, a lot of the dialogue does feel so of that time. And even West Side Story, which he also wrote the script for, right, it does feel like that you're in that time period. So I think, you know, getting help from Tony Kushner is always a good idea. But, yeah, you can kind of tell, like, Spielberg definitely has, like, the most, like, control over this story and, you know, is presenting in the way he wants to present it. And it's still, because it does feel vastly different from the rest of Spielberg's filmography.
Yeah, and I'm not discrediting Spielberg. If anything, it makes him a more impressive director, because he's able to take other people's scripts and make something great out of it too, or greater. Not to say that he's taking ownership, but he's kind of like David Fincher in a way, where David Fincher, I don't think, has directed a film that he's written, to my knowledge. No. Or
I think it's Mank he did, but I mean,
I thought his dad wrote Mank, but
I think his dad did, but I think he had some.
He had some, but he's like Fincher in how he's able to take literally anyone's script and make it something so like It's something great, honestly. And that's what's so great about Spielberg. That's why
I
love the guy.
And it's also, I think, like, you know, it's very interesting to kind of see how his filmography has really grown. I mean, he still obviously has so many films that, you know, making a top 10 list, like, it's very tough. I mean, for me, it's always been, like, Schindler's List, E.T., Close Encounters, and Jaws. And Lincoln. I mean, I like Jaws. I think Jaws has its impact. I mean, I always like those films, like, a lot better than Jaws. I mean, Jaws will still have its impact, but I think, like, you know, Spielberg has always, like, had such a big influence on me that, you know, it's kind of like, you can't really pick, like, a great film. I mean, you can't really pick, like, this undisputed great film because he has so many iconic things under his belt.
It's like Tarantino. Everyone's top 10 for Tarantino films is entirely different.
Well, yeah, I mean, Spielberg is just enough, like, in that zeitgeist with Scorsese. And, like, because I think you can name so many good films from them that, you know, even their later ones, although, like, may or may not be as good as, like, the ones they've done before, people will still love. They'll still eat it up.
It only just sucks when he makes something that's not good because it really sticks out, like Lost World, Jurassic Park.
BFG.
Actually, I like BFG. Yeah. I have a soft spot for Roald Dahl. There was one, The Terminal isn't that good. I would not.
I mean, it was well shot.
That's bad sentimentalism right there. That's just Oscar bait. And even the Academy didn't bite because I don't think it was nominated for anything.
No, it was not nominated for anything at all.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we're just about time for our conversation on The Fablemans. So final thoughts.
I mean, if you like have a need for like inspiration or need to find like a place to really get yourself like back on track with what you want to ultimately do, The Fablemans is the right film. I mean, I was definitely feeling that like this whole year so far, and I think The Fablemans really just kind of reinvigorated my passion for what I want to do and really take advantage of it. And Spielberg is still doing great things even to this day, and he'll still be like one of my biggest influences in terms of filmmaking because he's just created so many things and has already had such a significant impact on the cinematic landscape. And The Fablemans is just a nice type, as a great film to really watch, just to kind of show where somebody who would create like one of the best like dinosaur films and like Indiana Jones, like create one of the greatest like sci-fi films too, like really where his passion came from. And I think that's always like important to realize. And yeah, it could be sentimental, it could be cheesy, it can be a little bit long-winded, but I think The Fablemans is really worth the watch.
Yeah, I think this movie is great. It's one of Spielberg's best films like in recent years. Not to say Spielberg is making bad films, but at least in the past 10 years, they've been fine. Like, West Side Story really was the best thing he's made in so long, and Fablemans is pretty close because it is so different, yet it is probably his most personal project, probably next to Schindler's List, I would say. So, yeah, and if you have, even if you're not a filmmaker, even if you don't have a filmmaking background or you're a film student, you're still going to become emotionally attached to this movie in some form or another, whether it be the characters, whether it be the story, or even just the themes too, because the themes are so universal and can appeal to a wide range of audiences of various demographics. So yeah, I would highly recommend checking this movie out. It opens today at Film Scene at the Chauncey. It's a wonderful story, wonderful acting, wonderful production design and visuals, wonderful everything. It's a great movie. Check it out if you would like to. And I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
9 out of 10 for me.
9 out of 10? All right. Awesome. So we're going to move on from The Fablemans to a television special, or I guess more streaming special on Disney Plus, and that is called The Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special. The Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special is released on Disney Plus. It is the final product in Phase 4, and it was written and directed by James Gunn and stars the usual cast of Guardians characters: Chris Pratt, Dave Bautista, Karen Gillan, Pom Clemente, Vin Diesel, Bradley Cooper, Sean Gunn, the old 97's Michael Rooker, and Kevin Bacon. And the plot of this very entertaining special, basically, it mainly focuses on Drax and Mantis who travel to planet Earth to search for a present for Peter Quill, and they end up bringing back Kevin Bacon. That's the plot in a nutshell. It sounds ridiculous, but what more do you expect from Guardians of the Galaxy? So what did you think?
This is honestly a nice little special. I mean, I think the Guardians have always been, like, great characters. I mean, and obviously they're hitting their end. And next year with Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, at least, like, this iteration of Guardians. But, I mean, I still love it. It's great. I mean, despite being only 40 minutes long, it's, like, worth the watch. Because I think it's just so enjoyable, and you get to kind of see Kevin Bacon do, like, you know, fun things. Like, he's kind of a straight man in this one, and I honestly really liked his inclusion in this one too, like, unironically. And I think, like, really the ones that definitely do steal the show are Pom Klimatiff and Dave Bautista. I think they really have a lot of fun with the roles and just, like, you know, kind of act very alien in a play in Hollywood, which I don't know. I mean, I think Hollywood, you can act alien no matter what. Yeah. But I mean, it's Hollywood Boulevard. But I don't know. It's a fun film. I think it's a fun special. I think it definitely fits in with this time of year. And, you know, I think James Gunn, as long as he's on board, this just makes the film better.
Yeah, I've always loved Guardians of the Galaxy. Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2 are probably my favorite Marvel films. They're not my favorite superhero films. That honor probably goes to the Batman still. But in the MCU, they're my favorite films. So anything with the Guardians of the Galaxy, I'm immediately on board. And I'll be honest, if we're excluding No Way Home, this is probably the best thing Marvel has done in Phase 4, which is kind of sad, honestly, considering that just shows how insignificant and bad Phase 4 has been. But this special is just so ridiculous, but also it's so simplistic, and that's what makes it work so well. This is not a story that is like Endgame levels where it's like, oh, it's all this lore expansion and there's like, and it expands the universe and all that. It's oddly more grounded and focuses on one simple plot about trying to get a Christmas present, and it just so happens to take place in the universe of the Guardians of the Galaxy. But I think what makes it work is that it is just a feel-good, heartwarming special. And when we think of Christmas specials, we think of like Charlie Brown Christmas, The Grinch, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. The plots are so simple, but the themes are so, the themes are very much just like what we know. It's not doing anything new, but still when you hear them, it's very nice to just have a reminder of that. And oddly, that's what the Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special does. It does have that Christmas feel and shows the importance of Christmas. It's like spending time together with others. And also, yes, it's about giving, but also receiving, but just the thought that goes into that. And that's, I guess I didn't expect how bittersweet the special is, but also it's just funny. This is the first time James Gunn has written the Guardians of the Galaxy characters since Guardians of the Galaxy 2. And I remember seeing a tweet about this. I don't remember who it was, but someone mentioned that this is the first time that the Guardians actually felt like the characters since the second one, because every appearance of the Guardians since Volume 2 has been from another screenwriter. And even though James Gunn has been a consultant for how these characters were in, they just didn't feel the same. It's nice seeing them, obviously, but you could tell something is off, especially in Thor: Love and Thunder. The Guardians are in it, but they don't sound like the Guardians. This one, it's like, okay, James Gunn has full control. He knows these characters better than anyone else, and he commits to it. So yeah, this was fun. It was great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing like the part I do like a lot is just like how it definitely feels like a Guardians Christmas special. I mean, you get kind of that opening song with like the 1987, and just like hear them like plays on those guitars, and just like, you know, trying to think about what Christmas actually is. It's a really like funny opening number, and you know, it really definitely does set the tone pretty nicely. And I do kind of like it has some like throwbacks to like some holiday specials. Like they do kind of like that smooth animation that you can see, like,
that was
like in the backstory of Peter and Christmas, and just, you know, really seeing like something pretty amazing with that.
It's very much a, even the title and the opening animated flashback is very much a reference to the Star Wars Holiday Special, Star Wars Holiday Special is bad, but it's funny. So
yeah,
it's entertaining to see like callbacks to that, especially when George Lucas wants to bury it in the ground so no one will ever find it again, which I'm sorry, Lucas, we know about its existence, but yeah, it's nice to see that. And it does play around with genre and like styles too. It almost like takes elements from every single Christmas special as well as elements from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. The whole thing does still feel very Marvel-like, but also just happens to be a Christmas special. And I think that's what's really cool about this, is that it doesn't feel like a movie. Like, as much as I really like Werewolf by Night, and this is a good thing about that, is that it does feel just like a shorter feature-length film. But Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special is a TV special, undeniably. It doesn't feel like a movie. It's very segmented, but it's clearly meant for television. So.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, say, my grandparents are trying to find something on, like, cable, and this pops up on ABC.
This should go on ABC.
Yeah, honestly. I mean, it's probably going to pop up there. I mean, it's not like, I mean, because what, they don't even have the Peanuts anymore because it's out on Apple
TV. It's on Apple TV. Yeah, so, that makes me sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's good if you have Apple TV like I do. I mean, if you need to watch Ted Lasso every now and then, but I don't know. I think it's weird.
I actually did really like Kevin Bacon in this too.
Yeah, same.
It's just a fish out of water, and how there is a Batman reference in this too, which is pretty crazy. Yeah. I didn't expect to hear a Batman reference.
Yeah, it's insane. Like, I mean, I think Bacon does this a good job being Kevin Bacon, and I mean it. It's fun. It's kind of like funny. I mean, it's like one of those like odd cameos that you would see in like random holiday specials, and
or like the band too, the old 97s. Yeah. Just like you have the pointless celebrity cameo, but that also adds to just the overall cheese factor.
Yeah, right? It happens in like a lot of like holiday specials when you think about it.
Well, especially the Star Wars holiday special. It's just all like guest appearances and nonsense.
Yeah, like B. Arthur, Roger Corman, and it's like
Roger Corman. You mean Harvey Korman?
Harvey Korman. Yeah.
Roger Corman's a director.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he could have. I mean, who knows what Lucas was on that during that time?
Probably.
But like, I don't know. You kind of get like that nice holiday type special type thing, and I really enjoy it.
It also is it is visually very interesting too. Like, oddly enough, it seems like the CG in this special, for whatever reason, looks better than a lot of the movies that have been coming out. Like, I'm not even exaggerating. I think this is a better looking Marvel media product than like Black Panther 2, honestly, because it is creative, but it doesn't seem like at least maybe I just was in a good mood watching it. I just didn't notice the green screen. The keying isn't nearly as noticeable. Like, it seems like it's actually a different world, and the whole kind of plaza that they all congregate in is clearly a soundstage, but at least it's something physical. At least they built something and there's Christmas lights on it.
Yeah, I mean, when the old 87s were performing in the opening and I see Groot, it's like, wait, that's actually Groot.
Yeah, it's teenage Groot.
Yeah, and it's teenage Groot, but it's like, he looks so real. Like, you don't see the CGI as much. Like, it looks like somebody literally put on a suit and just started acting like Groot. It looks amazing.
I will say I do know, obviously, this is a story more focused on Drax and Mantis, who are both great characters. It would have been nice if the other Guardians had a little more to do. Like, it would have, honestly, if this was a story about Rocket and Groot going down to find a Christmas present, I think that would have been just as entertaining too.
Yeah, and I mean, but I don't know. I think that Palm Clement Tiff and Dave Bautista, we do a good job like really holding like this special. I mean, I think like especially Palm Clement Tiff, like, you don't see, because she's kind of seen as like the oddball of like the group, and
which is saying something.
Yeah, I mean, it really is, because you got like a talking tree and a
talking raccoon
and a talking raccoon, and now a talking dog played by Maria Bakalova.
Yeah, Cosmo the space dog.
Yeah, Cosmo the space dog, and now you got. But I feel like, you know, it's kind of nice that she's kind of given something to do and even, like, has some stakes in the story. I mean, which I don't know if it's a spoiler. I mean, it probably is a spoiler, so I won't mention it, but I probably just, like, maybe impact what could happen in Guardians 3, maybe.
Yeah. But even then, like, that little nod, I could see some people being like, oh, it's just shoehorned in, classic MCU, but I think within the context of this story, it only adds to that emotional bittersweetness of Christmas. How it's just like, it's not the gift that matters, it's like the not only the thought, but also coming together, being with others, and that sense of community, especially post-COVID with Christmas, that was very much lost too. And having that be a major focus of the special is really nice. And it's kind of like, obviously it doesn't touch into the religious part of Christmas. It's not like Charlie Brown Christmas, where it is actually about the true meaning of Christmas, but it's very close in how it's like, I could see like Disney, I don't think James Gunn obviously want to put religion into this special, but how it's like, okay, we want this to be about the true meaning of Christmas and not about commercialism, even though this is a commercial product, but it's hard as in the right place.
Oh yeah, it very much is. I mean, I think it's one of the specials where, like, you know, you watch and it's like, yeah, I had a good time with it. I mean, we'll kind of see what is next for the Guardians, but I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot.
We're going to transition to a quick Grant spot. We'll be right back with more BG Banter. Welcome back to BG Banter. We're continuing our conversation on the Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special. And do you have anything else to add?
I mean, really... The old 87s did a good job of the soundtrack.
Who are the old 87s?
I think they're like,
I actually don't know who they are.
They're like a band, and I'm definitely a band that I think that are very like. I listened to only one of their songs, but I know that it definitely falls into the genre that James Gunn loves, which is kind of like that little bit of like, you know, hard rock, kind a little hair metal esque, kind of like what it was with like Peacemaker. And that opening from Mike Wigwam.
Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, James Gunn, it definitely, like, it's music that fits him pretty well. Like, it's kind of like they're kind of like Bowling for Soup, if you remember that band.
Yeah, I remember Bowling for
Soup.
Yeah,
like Bowling for Soup. Like, it's really like, that's what they're kind of like. I mean, they're very much like that type of hard rock type thing that you would probably... You know, there's like some sort of nostalgia that kind of goes with it. That is very weird, but yeah, I mean, I think it worked out pretty well. I mean, I think there's kind of like this distinct feel around it. Like, yeah, this feels very much like a Guardians holiday special, and I think the old 87s do such a good job with it.
I think too that after Guardians of the Galaxy 3 comes out, the special is gonna make a little more sense because I'm just looking at the Wikipedia. James Gunn mentioned that there was a lot of setup and a lot of oddly important elements to Guardians of the Galaxy 3. So if you're a Guardians fan like us, you should probably watch this if you would like to understand the lore of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Yeah, all 40 and, minutes of it.
Yeah, like he specifically called this special a Trojan horse for Guardians of the Galaxy 3. So that's a hint right there. And especially with its ending, which we're not going to give away, that is a major clue to what we could expect in Guardians of the Galaxy 3. And also because the trailer just dropped not too long ago. I haven't seen the trailer yet for Guardians 3.
I've seen it. It's not a bad trailer. There's definitely a lot that seems to be going into it.
The only thing I saw were they were in spacesuits and people were saying like, oh, is it an Among Us reference? And James Gunn was like, no, it's not Among Us.
I mean, I'm pretty sure Among Us didn't exist until the 2020s.
I didn't know Among Us invented colors.
Yeah, like who knew, guys?
It's like Kimba the White Lion and Lion King.
Yeah, like I'm guessing, I mean, we could ask, I don't know, maybe ask Adam Johnston from YMS to see if like, If he maybe like, you know, do a full hour length editorial on how the suits are not Among Us. Like, yeah, who knows?
Yeah. I think do you want more stuff like this in the MCU going forward? Because obviously Phase 4 was just nobody knew what they were doing. There was no plan going into Phase 4. Hopefully with Phase 5 they'll rectify that. And it does seem like they're going to, especially because they announced the Kang Dynasty and everything. So I hope it's more focused.
Yeah.
But do you want stuff like this?
I wouldn't mind it. I really wouldn't mind it. I mean, I feel like the old MCU, like, it's kind of slowly dying at this point. I mean, because I feel like, you know, a lot of the old characters, like, you know, Iron Man, Captain America, those guys are basically done, obviously. And Hulk is somewhat done. And, I mean, I don't know, I mean... supporting role in She-Hulk. I mean, he did okay, but I feel like it's time for the new MCU. I mean, I feel that's what I'm ready for. And I think Guardians, like, to be honest, like, even apart from like the like their inclusion in Infinity War and Endgame, and even like Thor: Love and Thunder, I mean, I still love those characters. Like, I think I mean, and I feel like, you know, James Gunn is realizing that, you know, maybe the MCU is at a state where, you know, it's at a point where, you know, even the Guardians got to retire at some point. And I kind of want more of that, kind of like, you know, where Toy Story kind of like has those little shorts, like mm-hmm. after the trilogy was done before Toy Story 4. Like, I wouldn't mind those.
Well, it also, it doesn't help that James Gunn is going to be transitioning over to DC, especially after Black Adam came out, how there's like this whole restructuring going on over there. Unfortunately, it seems like the Guardians, kind of what you said, I don't want to say they're like dead, but they're probably going to be phased out, unfortunately, because, and also I'd rather them do that than have someone else replicate or try to write for the Guardians, because if their appearance in Thor 4 said anything, it just proved that nobody can write those characters as well as James Gunn. He needs to be the writer. He needs to have full control over these characters because he's the one who knows them best. So I would love to see more Guardian stuff just because I love these characters. I love the movies and I love the worlds that are in them. But if James Gunn isn't in it, then it's just like, just sure, like retire then.
Yeah, I mean, at least this iteration, I think he knows these characters a lot. I mean, he is a huge comic book fanatic. Like,
yeah.
Both Marvel and DC. I mean, and obviously DC is going through some changes right now with like Wonder Woman 3 being halted and Man of Steel 2 being halted as well. So it's like they're kind of in the process of trying to, you know, restructure some things at the moment. But, you know, I really trust James Gunn because he's just such a good, like, he does a really good job, like, understanding comic books and comic book characters. And I feel that, you know, hopefully we can kind of see what he can do next. And in terms of the Guardians, I mean, this is an iteration that I think they're time to be phased out. I mean, I kind of want to kind of, like, have them, you know, remembered as, like, you know, this great trilogy and this great film franchise, kind of like, you know, how the original iteration of the Star Trek characters, like, I want to remember them that way, not like in a way where it's like, oh, yeah, these are characters that have been going on for such a long time at this point. And I feel like, you know, I wouldn't be mad of seeing them phased out and, you know, bring in a new iteration. I mean, I like that idea.
Yeah, like a next generation.
Yeah, next generation.
Which that would also fit in line with the humor of Guardians of the Galaxy if they were to do like a next generation type thing where it's like, I don't know, with Peter Quill's son or something.
Yeah, Peter Quill's son. I don't know. Maybe instead of a tree, it could be a houseplant. Who knows? I mean, I want to see something.
Maybe there's going to be some multiverse stuff. They're probably going to do that.
Yeah.
Especially with
Quantumania, right?
Yeah, with Kang Dynasty and all that. They're going to do a multiverse Guardians of the Galaxy type thing. I'm willing to bet.
Yeah.
So
I'm excited.
Yeah, you got anything else?
I think, you know, the Guardians Holiday Special lives up to its title. I mean, it's a great, like, 40 minutes to watch. I think it's fun. Definitely has that holiday feel thanks to, like, the music and the production design and even the VFX, which are surprisingly good just for a 40-minute holiday special, and the story is very nice. I think it's just a nice little special to put on, and I don't know, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. I think it's a lot of fun. Sometimes the simpler the better, honestly.
Yeah.
It's funny how some of the, at least in Phase 4, these big like lore expansion, multiverse movies and just like, I don't know, going back to ancient Mesopotamia, those are not as good as this simple Christmas special. And I think even if you're not, probably one of the best things about it that I didn't touch on, even if you're not an MCU fanatic, if you don't follow everything, you can still watch this and have a good time. And I think that's probably, in my opinion, Marvel should do more of these just so it's like, okay, you can get a new audience that will just watch these, that they don't need to watch all the other films and get super invested. They could watch this and enjoy it for what it is. And that's what's important. Like, art first, profits later. Like, that's how, that's the mantra that they should go. So yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special. It's a lot of fun. If you want to watch something, if you'd like to, around the holiday season that's entertaining and relatively short, check it out on Disney Plus if you would like to. I really liked it. And I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. Well, what about you? Same thing?
Yeah, about the same thing. Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely worthy of that.
Yeah. Anyway, that concludes this episode of Bijou Banter, as well as Bijou Banter for the fall 2022 semester. Yep. We will return in January, maybe even during winter break. We'll talk about something.
I mean, there's still some stuff coming out that we might have to catch up on.
Yeah, maybe we'll do Avatar 2.
Maybe.
We might do that. But yeah, anyway, until next year, I've been Matthew.
And I've been Daniel, and have a happy holidays for all out there.
Yep, and we will see you all next time. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.